After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
It's not about making some great new ideal. It's taking the unique, particular life that you have and holding your life with compassion. And then seeing the lives of those around you and the circles that go beyond that. And every human life has its measure of sorrows and its struggle, every one. And remembering that it's possible to breathe and open and expand the capacity of heart to touch it all, to hold it all from your Buddha nature, from this great heart of compassion.
There comes a kind of relief just to be human with all of our flaws. Beautiful words by Jack Kornfield. Welcome to Heart Wisdom, Jack's podcast on the Be Here Now Network. I am Ganesh, honored to open the door to episode 232, Stop Being Loyal to Your Suffering, an episode all about the human condition, self-compassion, and uncovering the heart of the Buddha that lies within each of us. This is the second part of last week's episode on the divine abodes, the Brahma Viharas, of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity or peace. But this gem of a talk really stands on its own and contains some amazing references from Ram Dass to the Chicken and Rice Man to Viktor Frankl and David Roach and the Church of 80% Sincerity. This dream team of lively beings of true compassion and service, Jack conjures up to help showcase what is possible for us humans when we can have compassion for our human flaws, both for ourselves and the ones around us, and how when we stop being so loyal to our habits of suffering, we can live a life that is truly enjoyable, boundless, and of joyful service. And one small prescription that Dr. Jack gives is to turn off the news and do something enjoyable. Thank you, doctor. And speaking of transformative doctors with wise hearts, Jack is going to be joining Dr. Dan Siegel for a connected course called Living Beautifully, Transformative Science and Mindfulness Practices to Cultivate a Wise Heart. This is an online course starting April 15th with 11 hours of amazing content as well as two live question and answers with Jack and Dan. And just to make things fun, April 15th will be a doubleheader. Jack will be back for his Spirit Rock Monday Night Dharma Talk. These are always pay what you can and are really the guru bead on the mala for consistent Jack teachings. And then on May 20th, the next session of The Power of Awareness begins. This is a 7-week training on mindfulness and compassion. It is online with Jack, Tara Brock, Conda Mason, and Devin Barry. You can find links to Jack and Dan's course right here in the podcast notes. And for all other events and courses, you can head to jackkornfield.com, where you can steep in some amazing free offerings, meditations, Dharma talks, so many articles on just about everything you could think of, from really foundational Buddhism to overcoming afflicting emotions, meditation instruction, and so much more. So I will leave you there and pass you over to Jack for the ever so applicable episode 232, Stop Being Loyal to Your Suffering, finishing up this two-part series on the divine abodes. May you be happy, may you be healthy, may you help others through the authenticity of your being, and may your heart be smiling. Namaste.
So this is the first of these four. I don't even know if I'll get through them tonight, but we'll go wherever we go. This is the first of these four reminders of the awakened heart that is your own Buddha nature. The second one is compassion, which arises when love meets pain. Love is the kind of natural openness of the heart. And when love encounters that which is difficult or painful, it turns into the quivering of the heart, which is called compassion. Overcome any bitterness, say the Sufis, because you were not up to the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the sorrows of the world in her heart, we are each endowed with a certain measure of this cosmic pain. You are called upon to meet it in compassion and joy instead of self-pity. And what's true is that we have the capacity to meet the sorrows of the world with compassion as we do to meet the beauty of the world with love. The great heart of a Buddha is within you. And we get afraid that the heart isn't big enough, you know, that we don't have, that we'll get overwhelmed. But it is. I took this article out of the Sunday Times last week, maybe. It was the Chicken and Rice Man. I don't know if anybody saw it. 7 in the morning until 7 at night, weary-looking men dressed in threadbare jackets would watch, scan each passing car in the hope that someone would offer them work for a hard, grueling 10-hour construction job. "We come here for work," said one 40-year-old Ecuadorian man. He said he's sometimes gone days without eating, but for the past 3 months he's eaten at least one hot meal a day, thanks to a former immigrant who, with the help of his mother, has become a guardian angel for these workers. His man's name is Jorge Munoz, an elfin 43-year-old, and every night around 9:30, he arrives at the intersection with enough home-cooked fare to feed the dozens of day laborers who congregate there. Jorge is here. Doesn't matter, rain, thunderstorm, lightning. He'd do that from his goodwill, you know, someone said. Now, the relationship between Mr. Munoz and many of the men he feeds is really personal. "Uribe, you want more coffee?" he says. "Hey, Simon, you want seconds of this pasta?" In a way, Mr. Munoz seems to need these men as much as they need him. His unofficial meal program gives meaning and focus to his life. The operation is financed mainly from his $600 a week job driving a school bus, and all the cooking is done with his and his mother's help in a small house with gray siding where he lives. "I know these people are waiting for me," he said, "and I worry about them. You have to see them smile, man. That's the way I get paid. That's the way I get paid." And of course, you hear a story like that, and then you could also use it to beat yourself if you're into that. Those of you who like masochism, it's a fine thing. And say, well, you know, he's doing that. You know, and what am I doing? I remember when Ram Dass was teaching a class in Oakland on service and bodhisattva, and people were given, it was a series of many weeks, people were given practices and things to do. to pay attention to their connection with the suffering of the world and their fear of it or their capacity to be present for it. And one woman raised her hand in the class at one point, and she said that she'd really learned something. She said, every day when I go to work, for many, many months, there's a homeless guy that sits on my way to the BART, and I've been putting a quarter in his cup. But I realized since I started taking this class that I never really look at him, that I never look him in the eye. And then she said, so I began to pay attention. And all of a sudden, I realized why. I was afraid if I ever really looked him in the eye, that the next thing that would happen would be that he would be sleeping on my living room couch. And I didn't know what to do with that. And all of a sudden, her vulnerability and her honesty made the whole room of 1,000 people begin to say, well, what is right and what are our boundaries and what should we do? Because it's not just the chicken rice man in New York. It's our human dilemma. And what's true about compassion, about the circle of compassion, is that it's only complete if it includes yourself. We get really confused thinking, okay, I have to be compassionate for that poor person there who's suffering a lot. Oh, such pity for that person. But that's not the circle of compassion. The real meaning of compassion also has to include one other person. Guess who? Moi, as Miss Piggy would say, you know. If it's for them and not for oneself, it's not really compassion. It's something else. You know, and we could go into that. But genuine compassion includes the care for this one. You can search the tenfold universe, says the Buddha, and not find a single person more worthy of love and care than the one seated right here in your own body. So this one and that one, and we each have to find our way, our own balance. But I tell you, it is as natural to us as breathing. I mean, if we're not afraid, and we have to all find our own way and our own balance, it's natural to care. It just is. It's built in. It is your true nature. So my favorite kindergarten teacher in the whole world is a woman named Peggy. And Peggy said, told me this story some years ago, just at the beginning of the latest Iraq war, this one that we're in. She said that just around the beginning of that war, her kids were out on the playground, and there were some low-flying military planes that came over, because there was this whole movement of positioning equipment and all of those things at the beginning of that war to the Middle East. And because they were low-flying and loud and not the usual kind of airplanes kids see, her kindergartners came running back in, and they were really frightened by these planes. And they'd been seeing on television and talking to their parents about war is coming and things like that. And they said, these look like war planes, are they? And Peggy said, yes. And what are they? Well, they're planes with materials and weapons and bombs and various things that they're bringing there. And so the kids were very interested. And then one of the kids asked Peggy, well, are there kids like us in Iraq? And Peggy said, yes. And then another child said, well, they wouldn't bomb there then, would they? And Peggy said, well, they might. And then another kid said, well, then they must not know the children are there. They must not know this. We have to let them know. And so they took their recess period and they went out in the playground and they made this great big sign, you know, that could be seen from the air. Children in Iraq, they made a big picture of a child so that the pilots could see it. They must not know that there are children there. When you study Western psychology and the development of humanistic and transpersonal psychology, one of the great fathers of this is Abraham Maslow, and he made what was called a pyramid of needs. At the bottom was food and shelter, and then social needs and creative needs, and at the top was spiritual needs. And even he understood at the end of his life that he'd gotten it kind of, he didn't have the order exactly right. Because the truth is that we need love and compassion as much as we need food and air. And you don't have to have food and shelter and social needs and creative needs met in order to love or care for someone. That sometimes in some of the worst circumstances of the world, there is at the same time an outpouring of care. Viktor Frankl, the father of logotherapy, said that we who lived through the concentration camps can remember those who walked through the huts comforting others and giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but their very existence proves the greatest of all human freedoms, the freedom to choose your spirit no matter what the circumstances. So we talk about metta and loving kindness, and again, one of the problems is that then we make a new ideal about it and we get very idealistic. We can judge ourselves and things like that. One of the great local teachers that helps put things in perspective is a man named David Roach. And David Roach is the founder of the Church of 80% Sincerity. He said 80% is pretty good for humanity. He said if you could be 80% compassionate, 80% wise, 80% celibate, you know, it's actually pretty good. And David goes around teaching, and what's interesting about David is that he has a profoundly disfigured face. He was born with part of his jaw missing. And he goes into middle schools, sometimes high schools, but more than that, middle schools, to talk to kids and talk to them about trusting the reality of unconditioned love. But of course, he also acknowledges that it has a shelf life of about 10 seconds. Darling, I'll love you till the end of dinner, he says. He's got a very good wit. And he's wise, and he's funny, and sometimes he brings this beautiful woman that he's married to with him, and he says, look at me. He said, here I am, the worst thing that you can imagine, right? You know, what if I were deformed like this? You know, and the truth is that most teenagers think they are deformed. You know, they think that there's something wrong with their bodies or their faces or something like that. And here is like the worst thing. And he gets them to laugh, to recognize their self-pity and their fears. And there comes a kind of relief just to be human with all our flaws. And outwardly, he's difficult to look at, you know, and disfigured in a certain way. People say, oh, this is horrible. And inwardly, there is this shining, humorous, joyful, liberated spirit, this great beauty in him. And by the end of his talk, he says, okay, look at me now. You know, you couldn't even look at me when I came in. How do I look to you now? I look different, don't I? And this whole outpouring, of course, because they see him. They see who he is behind all of that. And that's really more our human situation. It's not about making some great new ideal. It's taking the unique, particular life that you have and holding your life with compassion and then seeing the lives of those around you and the circles that go beyond that. And every human life has its measure of sorrows and its struggle, every one. And remembering that it's possible to breathe and open and expand the capacity of heart to touch it all, to hold it all, from your Buddha nature, from this great heart of compassion. And the difficulties, they are as much our teachers as anything. Elie Wiesel, Nobel Prize winner, says, suffering confers neither privileges nor rights. It all depends on how you use it. If you use it to increase the anguish of yourself or others, you are degrading it, even betraying it. And yet the day will come when we shall understand that suffering can elevate human beings. God help us to bear our suffering well. So to be free, meditation, sit with joys and sorrows and pleasure and pain and all of the fabric of our humanity, to be free is to find this seat of open-heartedness and compassion for the incarnation on this earth, because nobody, not a single person, doesn't have pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. It happens for us all. It's woven into life, birth and death. And this is our humanity. Here you are. How do you treat it? So there's loving kindness, there's compassion, and there's not very many minutes left, but we'll talk a little bit about the other two, which are joy and equanimity or peace. Compassion and suffering are not the end of the story. There is also a tremendous importance in spiritual practice on joy, and joy in yourself, and then the sympathetic joy and the happiness of others. And, you know, you sit and the comparing mind comes and it says, well, how about this and that and so forth. I like to tell that little cartoon. You know, people make a grim duty out of meditation. Oh, okay, I'm going to meditate and make myself better. Forget it. You know, you're just going to be yourself. It's like looking in the mirror. You get who you are. And you could love, but you're not going to change yourself very much. It doesn't have to go to the gym and go to therapy and all that stuff. You have this incarnation, you know, get with the program. It's how it is. But you could love. And, you know, you sit down and you say, I'm going to quiet my mind. And there's that cartoon that shows the car going across the Utah desert, this vast landscape, and the little roadside sign says, your own tedious thoughts next 200 miles, right? You have a mind, it tells stories, and it likes, and it dislikes, and so forth. But underneath that all is, if you've been in the Utah desert, it's magnificent. It's absolutely glorious. When we get out of the thought structure of the mind and let the eyes open and the heart open, there comes this incredible beauty and joy that's possible. E.B. White, essayist, said, I wake in the morning torn between the desire to save the world and to savor it. And saving the world isn't enough. The world doesn't need you to save it. That would be pretty egotistical. It needs you to care for it, contribute a piece. But it equally needs us to savor it. Despair is a greater deceiver than hope. It really fools us. And the world is too beautiful and gloriously magnificent for despair. You read about Rumi, the poet. There's an enormous generosity and humor in his work. Fresh, wild moments within a profound peace. Drunken lyrics dissolving within a starry clarity. Spontaneous pleasure and discipline dancing together. And this is possible for us. And when we meditate, it's like, you know, turn off the news. You already know the story. You don't only need to watch. You could skip, you know, some months and you'd kind of get the same old, it's just reruns. You know that. It is. Turn off the news and go for a walk. Turn off the news and put on Mozart. Go by the ocean. Know that André Gide, the French author, philosopher, André Gide says, know that joy is rarer, more difficult, more beautiful than sadness. Once you make this all-important discovery, you must embrace joy as a moral obligation. And so there is something about this. Not, you know, we're so loyal to our suffering. We are, you know. And we need compassion in this world, as I've said. It's terribly important. But at the same time, it's not the end of the story. Speaking of stories, which shall I pick? Ah. I'm an artist, and when my daughter was born, after a difficult labor, we had an emergency cesarean operation. We were very worried. I was there at the hospital. I remember talking with the doctor about what I did for a living. I said, I'm an artist, and the doctor confided in me. I said, I wish I'd been an artist, actually a musician, because I love to play the concert piano. Later, after my wife had the delivery and the doctor came out with the good news that she was fine and I had a brand new baby girl, we're standing there and I received the news. Another doctor walked up to the physician who just completed the cesarean surgery, delivered my child, and said, "Excuse me, doctor, I just want to tell you, you performed brilliantly in there. It was an honor to assist you." And I turned to him and I said, "Now tell me the truth. You've just brought a new life in the world, saved another one, and you've had one of your colleagues tell you it was an honor to be in your presence. For heaven's sake, can you honestly say you wish you'd been a musician?" The doctor grinned and nodded, said, "Yeah, it went pretty well in there." We both laughed, and he said, "And I know exactly why, too. Because this morning I got up early, and for an hour I played Chopin at the piano." And there's something so important about our capacity for appreciation, to allow for our joy and to see the happiness in others. And I tell people when they meditate that sometimes rapture will come. There's 25 kinds of rapture in the Buddhist psychology. You know, we've got Western psychology, there's 25 forms of anxiety and depression. In Buddhist psychology, there are 25 forms of rapture. And when well-being and joy starts to arise, let yourself smile, let yourself laugh, let your body be filled with it, let your senses open. People will come on retreat and they'll do walking meditation and they come in, especially at the end, it's like, you know, people look younger and this great joy opens and they'll say, "I was out walking on the grass and I felt like I was 2 years old again, like this little kid, this beginner's mind, the plants, the trees, everything starts to open up." Quiet the mind and open the heart, and then you start to catch it from one another. When you're open and you see the joy in another and the night sky and the turning of the seasons, here we are almost at the winter solstice. Consider the generosity of the one-year-old, another Alison Luderman poem, who has no words to exchange with you yet and instead offers up her favorite drooled-on blanket, her green dinosaur as big as she is, her cloth doll with the long blonde pigtails, and her battered cardboard books. If you were outdoors, she would hand you a dead beetle, a fistful of grass, a pebble, by way of introduction, or just because. And if a moment later she wanted it back, it would be for the joy of the game, giving and returning, that makes every simple object a holy offering. In the same way, sun drapes a buttered scarf across your face, rose opens herself to your glance, and rain shares its divine melancholy. The whole world keeps whispering or shouting to you, nibbling your ear like a neglected lover. And the practice, just like there's a practice of loving kindness, there's a practice of compassion. May you be held in compassion. May your suffering be eased. There's a practice of joy. Picture the happiest person you know or someone that you love a lot and see them at their happiest moment. And then you begin to wish inside, may your joy increase. May your happiness grow. May the causes for your happiness grow. And you do that for them and another, and then you can turn it back on yourself as if they were wishing you well. May your joy grow. May your happiness increase. May my own happiness increase. May the causes of for this happiness. And there comes this beautiful sense of blessing that you are able to bless and to be blessed. You know, and we tend to be a little stingy sometimes with our emotions and appreciation, like we're going to run out of love and joy, like it's some little battery in there and you only have so much and then you've got to go plug it in at night again and get some more of it or something like that. But it doesn't work that way. It's not like a little battery. We are actually a channel for the sacred. We're a channel for the energy of the divine that is who we are. And as you love more, or as you open the great heart of compassion, or as you see the beauty around you and let yourself dwell in the joy of life, it grows. It opens. It's like the channel gets clear and more of it flows through you. And then the last, and I have just a few minutes to speak to it, is the quality of peace, equanimity. And equanimity isn't an indifference. That's the near enemy, detachment. I don't care about things. Equanimity is really the stillness or the peace in the midst of all things, the still point in the center of the world, of this great turning world, that was the resting place of the Buddha, and that's the resting place of every great heart, yours as well. And it's such a mystery. You know, there was this cartoon in the New Yorker, yes, a dark hole in our own galaxy, 300 million light years across, does make me feel insignificant. But all I have to do is look around at my colleagues and my equanimity is restored. Albert Einstein. Where are you, Albert? He says, the most beautiful and most profound emotion we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. It is the source of all true science. And for one whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer stand wrapped in awe, is not still really alive. You know? So here we are in this great, incredible mystery that nobody knows. I mean, you don't know how you got here. Anybody know for sure? Raise your hand. Isn't that phenomenal that we're here? Look, all these people. You'd think somebody would know, right? You know? And yet here we are in this mystery of galaxies and stars and, you know, a million kinds of beetles on this earth. There are a million species of beetle on this earth. It's phenomenal. How did this all get here? And here we are incarnate, all this. The most beautiful thing. And so instead of getting lost in the small sense of self and taking it for granted, there grows a deep sense of trust that we're supposed to be here, that we are, in fact, a part of the web of life, of what's called interdependence with all things. And so instead of the small sense of self, the body of fear, there grows this vast sense of space, which is what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is the space of awareness. The Buddha said you can put a teaspoon of salt in a cup and taste it, and it will be very salty. But if you put the same teaspoon of salt in a lake, you can't even taste it. The lake absorbs it all. And speaking of salt, there is in Colorado an artist who made a work called the Salt Monument. And she built this beautiful wooden room structure, 10 feet or more high, like a beautiful room for it. And in the middle of this room, or 15 feet high, in the middle of this room is a 10-foot high lucite plastic crystal, the shape of a salt crystal. And in it is 6.5 billion tiny crystals of salt, one for each man, woman, child, each person on the earth. And she has it hooked up so that it rotates and turns once every 24 hours the way the earth turns. And she's the priestess, if you will, at the Salt Monument. Every morning, she goes and climbs up this ladder and takes a little cup of salt and pours in 250,000 grains of salt, which are for every person that is born or will be born that day. And then every evening before she goes to sleep, she makes a prayer and then draws off from the bottom of it another container of 200,000, slightly smaller container of 200,000 grains of salt for everyone who died that day on this earth. And then around the room are these little jars, like, here are all your friends, this tiny little thing of salt, right? And all the people in your neighborhood and all the people you'll meet in your lifetime, and then there's all the salt for all those people. And it's really the witnessing of the dance of life itself. And when we have this vast perspective of time and space, there comes an ease and a generosity and a peace, not because we remove ourselves from life, but actually because we become part of life. And it's not our responsibility then to fix others, but to love this beautiful world that we're born into. The recitation for the practice of equanimity is that all beings are the heirs of or the recipients of their own karma. Their happiness and suffering depends on their actions and not my wishes for them. Which is a very kind of amazing statement and rather fierce to say. But it means, in a most fundamental way, that we can love people and care for them and be responsible and care for the injustices of the world and plant the beautiful seeds and so forth. But it's not given for us to control it. We can add our part and do beautiful things and do them where they're necessary as well as we can. But if you think you own it and control it, sorry. It's just now, you don't even own your own body. How about your mind? Okay, no more of those 200 miles of tedious thoughts. Stop it. Does it listen? Okay, don't grow old, you say to your body. I'm not going to get a day older. Does it listen? You know, and then you try and control your children. Ah, you know, or your partners, your lovers, your spouses. See how far that gets you, you know. This is not the reality. This is not the dance. We are traveling with tremendous speed toward a star in the Milky Way, says Bertolt Brecht. A great repose is visible today on the face of the earth. My heart's a little fast, otherwise everything's fine. And that everything's fine is the eyes of wisdom and compassion that says there's sorrow and struggle that we have to tend to, and there's birth and there's death, and there's praise and blame and gain and loss, all of these things that make art be our humanity and that we engage in. But the place of peace is this vast perspective that Einstein spoke of awe and mystery. And it's not ours to control. It's ours to love and to enjoy with joy, to bring blessings of loving kindness and compassion to, and to remember this noble heart with which we are born. And these are really the teachings and the practices that make it possible for us to live from our Buddha nature. So let's sit for a moment. O nobly born, O you who are the sons and daughters of the Buddhas, of the awakened ones, do not forget who you really are. The great heart of compassion and wisdom and love, joy, is yours. It is within you. So, one or two very brief announcements and a tiny chant, and we'll go out into the autumn winter evening. Emily needs a ride to North Berkeley. Anybody going over to the East North Berkeley who could give her a ride? Emily, would you meet this person up here right after? That would be good. Again, next week we'll share some snacks and slides and some metta, loving kindness practice, a little bit of a Dharma talk, and a little bit of a celebration at the end of the year. Thank you for your kind attention and generosity in many, many ways to support this beautiful place for yourself and others. And so the last thing is just to end with a chant. In India, when you meet someone, the greeting is namaste, which means I honor the divine within you. I see who you really are. And the root of the word namaste in Sanskrit is the word namo, which means to bow to or honor. And I'd like us to simply chant it 9 times tonight. And as you do, you can feel what you want to bow to, your own good nature, to the beauty of another that you think of, to the suffering of another that needs your care and compassion, to some place in the world that you want to offer your respects or your concerns. So. Namo. 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 Add harmony. Namo. 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 One more. Namo. And may your week and the turning of the seasons, darkness into light, all of this be filled with blessings. Thank you. Drive politely out there. It's lots of cars and it's crowded.